The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Join the Save Our Shirt movement today. More at saveourshirt.co.uk.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to make my country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Back with us. Manchester United 1-0 up against Arsenal, 47 minutes in the clock. McTominay with the goal. We just saw another replay of it there, Dan. Took even more of a deflection than I'd fully realised. A very, 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 very helpful deflection. It was still a reasonable strike, but was probably going more central in the goals.
Flight-altering direction.
Yeah.
So enough to be a significant factor in the goal, rather than just maybe taking a bit of the aesthetic pleasure away from it.
Roy Keane doing punditry. Wouldn't have given a deep tactical breakdown of things there, just watching. That may not be his style as pundit, but he did certainly say that the quality on show, frightening. Not in a good way.
Not in a good sense, yeah. You know how people now sometimes use words that might have a negative connotations, but it's actually positive?
I do, yeah.
You know, this whole thing of something being sick, it's like, what? Sick? It's like, but unwell? It's like, no, that's really good. It's like, I have to get my head around this. So frightening in a bad sense now. This has gone the opposite direction. Well, this is it. Like, it's mainly like an Arsenal game. I don't really feel that engaged by it. I mean, what's at stake here? It's a battle for a top four place, you know, maybe later in the season or something like that. You know, it's not, you don't feel like this is a game that's it's going to change the flow or the pattern of the season in any way.
No.
So, I mean, well, like, we'll see where they both are in March. Probably around a similar place in the table.
Dan McDonald's official response to this evening is, meh.
Well, that's not quite my official response to the evening as a whole. So we know the things going on in the world, Joe.
Pan Nevin's watching this game. He'll give us his thoughts on it.
He'll tell us what's happening.
We're juggling a few things, and I know you've used some of the last hour to file for tomorrow's Irish Independent, where presumably the John Delaney story trickles on. It feels like it will go quiet-ish now until Monday. Shane Ross has been out. Fergus O'Dowd's been out. All the usual people have said, well, maybe the terms of his agreement with the FAI should have been made public. You suspect they will be in November at the latest when these accounts are published. Is that what
Reviews.
Whatever.
Yeah. Well, so the accounts. The reviews are ongoing. Yeah. The accounts are presented in November.
No.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're right. Like, they're almost interlinked.
Sure.
Two things at this stage. You know.
But beyond that, not much will happen. So the first report due of several is Monday, 7th of October. That's the one commissioned by Sport Ireland, carried out by the accountancy firm Cozy, based in Uri. Mm. Other reports include Mazars, which will give maybe a broader sense of the structural problems around the organisation. That's one commissioned by the FAI themselves. Grant Thornton are hanging around as well. I'm not quite sure who's commissioned that one. And then also the Office of the Director for Corporate Enforcement. I'm not actually sure if they publish a report.
Oh, no, that's a different one. That's like, that's almost separate to everything. That's an investigation that could take years. I think Grant Thornton is sort of feeding into Mazars a bit. I think it's basically the Cozy one, Mazars, and then ODC is almost separate to them all. And the ODC one isn't really going to be affected. Like the other ones are sort of commissioned within sport, it's Sport Ireland and the FAI and various, you know, it's the implications are sporting, I guess, you know, and the running operations of the football body, whereas the ODC one, I mean, it has all sorts of potential. I mean, you know, it could end up in the criminal realm.
What is the difference between the Mazars report and the Grant Thornton report?
I think that the Grant Thornton report was specifically, and I think Grant Thornton initially were providing guidance specifically around the €100,000 transaction, as far as I know.
They were innocent days when it was just the €100,000.
But they were there for a while as well, so I mean that could very possibly be wrong.
Mm. It may well have expanded now.
Yeah, the division between the I can't remember who came first. You know, it's like the worst pub table quiz of all time. List these FAI reviews in order of chronology. Like, which came first? You know, was it Mazars? Was it Grant Thornton? Was it UEFA? Cozy was down the list. That'd be down towards the bottom.
Well, Cozy's new. Cozy is Sport Ireland. Once the Oireachtas thing happened and Sport Ireland realised that this thing was becoming a fiasco, then they said, right, we need to go in here and have our own report done. We actually don't trust the FAI anymore to do their report, even if it is independently commissioned.
Yeah, and there was another review into the cyber hacking as well, which was a separate review.
In another year, the Russian hacking thing would be bigger than anything.
The Russians, you say?
Have I got that wrong?
Well, no, there was a cyber hacking attempt. I don't think it's ever been clarified that it was Russians, though.
Did I just dream that up?
I think you possibly did.
Okay.
Either that or after breaking a really big story.
No, I'm not.
Scratch that. The Russians.
No.
The Russians hacked it when? Who's involved in this?
Have I dreamt that up totally?
Like, is Andriy Shavin involved in this?
Shevchenko, Pavlyuchenko? I think as well, yeah.
Shevchenko is Ukrainian.
I know.
See, this is...
Well, not for long. No, I think I'm all over the shop there. Don't mind that. Where have I dreamt that from?
Well, I mean, maybe...
No,
Trump. I'm thinking CNN, Joe. You know? Why would you make some... Why would American politics... Well, actually, there's a John Delaney standing for election in America at the moment, which actually makes searching John Delaney's name on Twitter a very complicated business, because you want to look at like an update of what's happening with John Delaney, and what you end up getting is something from the caucuses in Iowa. You know, it's completely distracting. Then sometimes you can't tell between the two because someone's having a go with them in a particular way. It's like, is this about John Delaney?
Can we believe anything John Delaney's saying?
Yeah, you're looking at this going, well...
I'm talking about the US John Delaney.
Exactly,
there,
who are you talking about?
The US one.
Yeah. But the Russians, as far as I'm aware, not involved.
Okay, scratch that then. I don't know where the hell I dreamt that up.
If they are, let us know.
So, just to deal with this for the end of the
year. Yeah, we're sort of flippant, you know, in what is actually a horrendous story.
Well, let me say, for people just tuning in, if you think we're being a bit flippant about this, we've already talked about it for about 20 minutes at 7:30. It was the main story. Dan's gone through everything there in a good bit of detail, where we are, how we got there. Podcast listeners, I appreciate you've already just heard that, so we're not going to repeat it ad nauseum. Is there anything else you want to add to the 7:30 chat?
Not especially. I mean, I guess a point that should be made, and like what needs to happen going forward, is like we've had this situation where the identity of the FAI has been wrapped in with, like, if I said to you, FAI, right, you know, what does the FAI stand, or what do you think of when you think of the FAI? I think a lot of people would have an image of like John Delaney and the board and a certain perception that I think, like, there are people, and we've touched on it earlier, there's a lot of good people working in the FAI who, like, during the past year at various times, I know, because I've spoken to them, were like afraid of being seen out in their FAI tracksuits. You know, they were afraid. Like, people who were sort of working in development and coaching and, you know, being a positive force for the game, felt ashamed of their association with the FAI. And like how that can happen, and how that just can't be allowed to happen again. And I know there's a bit of a preachy sort of Jerry's final thought thing there or something, you know, but there is that element of what a sad story this ultimately is. And there's a great intrigue and almost fascination with some of the details, and it's like, and there was that element of shock factor of like what's coming next, and oh, look at the largesse here and the spending here, and what about the Ritz-Carlton, and what about everything? But like behind it all is like a wasted decade.
Yeah.
Maybe a wasted decade and a half, but particularly a wasted decade. And it's just something that, and I'm trying to do a piece about it tomorrow, that like there's a lot of established, like it's not just all solved because John Delaney, say, moves out of stage left here. He exits stage left. Like the football administration in the country, full stop. There's a lot of people who've been around for a long time in particular roles, and like there's been an element of like ownership over positions. You know, like the game doesn't belong to anyone. You know, like there's, and you hope that the changes going forward, where, you know, reforms of term limits and stuff, that there's a constant refreshing of ideas and people, because you can't just imagine that football is like certain people and that's their gig and that's their brief and that's their administration. There has to be more open forum for ideas going forward, and you hope that's going to happen. But there's still a lot of people there, not a million miles away, to seats of power and influence, that are very much a product of the whole old regime, and That's just something that you have to bear in mind, that it doesn't just stop here because one change has happened, much as that was a badly needed change.
The word seems to be that Donal Conway is attacking the new job with a bit of vigour and good intent. And yet the Minister for Sport, amongst others, has said, you're just too connected with the past to stay on here. Your position's not tenable because of that. And he's refused to go and said he's staying on for a year to oversee the transition to a new dawn. What do we understand about the work Conway is doing now? And is his position seen as tenable within the FAI? Is there disgruntlement that he is staying on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a talking point in the coming weeks. As much, like he did say previously that, you know, he didn't feel there was anything coming out in the particular, you know, reviews that was going to pose him particular problems. But, I mean, that could be very, you know, that could be very individualised in the sense of, you know, and then Donal Conway. But the fact that he was part of a board during this period, it is the issue that probably won't go away from him.
And I think publicly it doesn't help his case, whether this is fair or not, but it doesn't help his case that on the day of the Oireachtas hearing, which effectively was a nail in the coffin, I think, from a public point of view on this whole thing.
That was the day it really turned.
That was when I realised, oh, actually, they're not surviving this. That was the first day I thought.
Some people thought differently at the time. They actually thought it had gone quite well.
No.
It's just extraordinary.
I think actually under the circumstances, Donal Conway performed very well. Because John Delaney said, I can't say nothing. I'd love to help you out. But I mean, I've got my legal advice, so I'm just going to sit here. I can answer any questions not to do with my 14 years as CEO, though.
Mm.
So ask away. And Conway was left to pick up a disaster, really. And, you know, the treasurer not knowing how many bank accounts they had. And it was a fiasco. I think under the circumstances, he performed quite well that day. But
yes.
In the public's eye, he was sat there alongside John Delaney. He was very much helping John Delaney out here by answering questions that he wouldn't answer and doing the dirty work in some respects is how it was seen. So for that reason, I think in the public's eye, whether it's fair or not, he's just too associated with the Delaney era.
Yeah, I mean, around that time, there was a European under-17 draw in the Aviva where the FAI were hosts, but John Delaney was actually the UEFA speaker. And I think there was some sort of gushing praise of him from Conway introducing him. And obviously, listen, that would have been speech written stuff, you know, like that happens, but that plants the perception. And what I know a lot of people who would be critical of the FAI who would, you know, and would have been very unhappy, and they might be inside the FAI structure now, who would tell you, they'll say, he's done well, like he's worked hard, he's thrown his life and, you know, he's thrown his energies into it.
Okay.
In such a way, though, it's like, well, where was that for the last 10 to 12 years? And this is the problem. Maybe life isn't fair sometimes in that respect, but I keep making this point. There's a lot of people in the last 10, 12 years who've left the FAI in a bad way, you know, whose job it was, who lost job or redundancies, or they were sort of cut out of this inverted commas football family that supposedly existed. And people who were there all the time through that, and you're not suggesting that they were, you know, that they are bad people in any way, but they were part of that environment that existed. So yes, there's a sense of maybe trying to atone in some way, and you can laud that and say, well, like, you know, well done for your service at this point, but it's still an obstacle to Donal Conway continuing.
Like a more cynical view of that could be he's just trying to change his own legacy, change his own
And I think that is a point of view that I don't think he could take issue with someone holding that opinion, given that you can run through a list of statements and stuff where he would have been privy to and you know, quoted in. And, like, you know, being the president of the FAI is an honour. There's good things that come with that.
And it's still his intention to go in a year, though, isn't it?
It is. And, again, like, there's a talking point over whether he will see out that year. I still don't think it's far from, okay. I would say that's far from assured. We'll see what happens over the next couple of months, that there may be a call if there's a new board structure coming in. Do you do the handover a bit earlier? Because once you've done the transition for the various reviews and they're completed, what function is the handover person playing? Because he is staying because it was a recommendation of a governance review report
that
there should be up to two stay.
Two.
So, like, they're acting upon that. That's the reason that's been given. But is there a point where actually that work ceases? And I think that's probably the way the things will play out.
And there are going to be four new independent members of the board. Is that right?
Independent directors coming soon, yeah.
When does that happen?
At one point, it has been spoken about for the games in September, which hasn't happened. I understand a lot of people applied because there was like an independent firm who basically ran an advertisement in a couple of newspapers to seek independent candidates, and quite a few people applied.
Did you?
I did not do so. No. Did you?
No.
There you go. Why would I apply?
Would you not be well qualified to do it?
No, I wouldn't have thought. I think it could be slightly compromised to some degree.
Okay. Well, you'd have to give up your job at the Irish.
Yeah, to be an independent director for what, you know? I mean,
the privilege of being part of the football family.
Yeah, you need to make a living, Joe. you know. But you would hope that it's people, like you'd hope that it's people from a particular environment that actually, we're only joking there, but like that it's someone. I don't want it to have opinions from these people before they start. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, this person here, well, actually, they're an ally of them, or they were linked to this and they were linked to that. Now, there could be some excellent people in that bracket.
That's hung over Noel Mooney, for instance, that he's allied to the previous regime. Would you like people to go to the board who are more football people or are more business people and come from good corporate environments?
I think you can do a bit of both, can't you? With four. Yeah. There's an argument that it should have been six.
That was Niall Quinn's issue,
wasn't
it?
Quinn has made that point, yeah. And I don't think Quinn himself has gone for it. And I think, you know, there's people like who've played football at a good level. Like, this is one of these things. Like, there's people who've played football at a high level that are doing very well in business and other worlds. They don't necessarily all have to have worked in football as chairman or chief executives or managers. You know, there's a lot of people who would have played football here who would probably, you know, be aware of the lie of the land here, who would be like qualified in sort of high powered professions or have worked running their own businesses and stuff like that. So I think having someone with a football connection is not a bad thing, I guess. To slightly contradict myself, but you could have one or two people there who have a very different focus, you know, who don't have a stake in the game, who might have done something in whether other sports or a completely other field. Yeah. I can see it's about having a bit of a balance. And I think that's what was lacking on the board before, was a real balance in terms of skill sets. It was very hard to see what distinguished one person from the next.
Well, there was a power imbalance too. We'll take a short break. So that's FAI chat done. Dan was in from 7:30. If you want to catch the podcast, if you've just tuned after 9 and wanted to get your fill on what happened over the weekend between John Delaney and the FAI, I should update you on events at Old Trafford. So Aubameyang scored. He was played in and De Gea came out, and in a very nice way, he just dinked the ball over De Gea, who went to ground with his left foot. Really nice finish, Aubameyang. And instantly, the linesman's flag went up to say offside. Good job Aubameyang played out the move where the ref didn't blow his whistle, because then they looked at it on VAR, and as the pass was played through to Aubameyang, you're watching the finish here, it's a really nice finish, as the ball was played through to Aubameyang, right in front of the linesman, like it's extraordinary actually, right in front of Aubameyang, or in front of the linesman, Harry Maguire sprinted up. He was he was miles behind everyone, he must have been caught making a tackle or doing something, so he tried to sprint up to get in touch with the line. And the linesman seemed to misjudge when Maguire actually reached the line. So he had his flag up, and then they went to VAR and the goal was given. So it was a perfectly good example of a legitimate goal being given. Now I need to watch it again. Solskjaer's given out over something. I'm not sure, is it the goal or is it something else?
I don't know, is there a suggestion that people stopped in any way? I don't know, the Manchester United players, from seeing it, seemed reasonably committed to finishing out the phase of play.
Yeah, no, they were.
But I'm wondering. I mean, I think it's a type of decision that I think people are going to rage over anyway, because they're still just getting used to this adjustment, you know, to some degree.
But it looked right to me. I mean, when you see it again and you see how much Maguire played Aubameyang onside, it's a no-brainer decision. Effort from Pogba, just wide. Really good effort. Tried to curl it in the right-hand post. So still 1-0, 64 minutes on the clock. We'll take a short break. Pat Nevin will join us. He's been watching this game. We'll get his thoughts and then ask him about the weekend's football as well.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag SaveOurShirt.
Welcome back. So let's go to Pat Nevin, who's been watching this top of the table. Scratch that mid-table clash. Oh, Pat, you see what I did there? It's not fair. The last 10 years have not been kind. How you doing?
I'm great. Well, I was great, and then I watched most of that first half, and then I was less great.
How bad?
Do you know, the weirdest thing about it is it was just the paucity of the passing, the bad decision making. It was just a mess. I've never, honestly, rarely seen that many mistakes in a Premier League game in a row. And it didn't seem as if anybody was playing particularly well. Now, I know it's raining and I know there's all those sort of things going on, but come on, really? It was really, really poor. Until we got a Scotsman, obviously, who stands up and puts a little bit of quality in there.
And we were crying out for a Scotsman. We were just saying that here 10 minutes in.
Funnily enough, I've never seen McTominay do that one before. It's really odd. Like, McTominay does well in centre midfield for Man United, and McGinn does brilliantly for Aston Villa, and then they turn up for Scotland and then nothing happens.
Tierney and Robertson as well. Like, Scotland have a really good crop of elite players at the moment. And then the national team, I don't know, Pat. Like, sum up the national team in a sentence, without being unkind.
Without being unkind, one sentence, nay centre backs, nay strikers, that's it.
That's pretty matter of fact.
At least he worked in nay.
Well, you asked the Scottish question. Yeah.
Good. And have things picked up dramatically, or give or take?
Are we talking about Man United again here?
Yes, we are.
Not Scotland.
Definitely not Scotland.
Please get off Scotland quickly. I'll start talking about rugby next. Yeah. No, actually, in actual fact, it's got a little bit better in that second half. Okay. Obviously, that goal's lifted it. And you know what it's like in these games. You get a goal, it opens it out a little bit. And good old VAR, eh? Got it right. Saved our bacon on this occasion. So there's been a lot of moaning about it recently. And I understand that. I get it. But, you know, it would still be 1-0 just now. And it shouldn't be. It should be 1-1. Another goal, well-taken goal. And that, I don't even think that's a particularly good scoreline for either team, is it? 1-1. They need better than that.
Not especially, no. We were just here. Well,
can I ask you about one question?
Yeah, go on.
Have you been watching this as well?
Well, I was just about to say, we're half watching here because we're trying to talk through the ongoing issues within the Football Association of Ireland, which, trust me, are nay good.
Yeah, but, it makes Brexit sound easy.
It's akin to Brexit.
It actually is. It's our Brexit.
Yeah, it's our Brexit.
We are also involved in Brexit, to be fair. But anyway,
neither will end well. Yeah. But looking here, we were chatting, and I just happened to look over. I saw the goal, and then I saw the offside, and I continued chatting to Dan, and I thought, well, I'll update the listeners on this in a few minutes' time. And then I saw the replay, and it looked to my eye as I was listening to Dan explain potentially legally tricky issues, but it looked like Maguire had played him well onside, and this was right in front of the linesman.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, good 3 yards onside, but it's that classic one. When you show it in the telly and you freeze frame it, or else you show it in slow motion, it looks as if it's a disastrous mistake by the assistant referee. In actual fact, even you go to these conferences with the refs and the assistant linesmen of assistant referees talk, that's the tricky ones. Somebody who sprints right in front of your eye line while you're watching something further away. Now, we've got a panoramic view and we've got freezes and all the rest of it, but if something happens right in front of your eye line, you know, a guy runs in front of you 2 yards away from you or 5 yards away from you, but you're watching a ball that's like 60 yards away from you, it's almost impossible for the human brain to calculate it. And it's classically one of those ones that everybody up in the stand is in a better position than the assistant referee to see it. And that is why we've got VAR. And I'm delighted we got it that time. So it looked bad, but to be honest, from his point of view, you know the one that I keep on going on about, Sean Massey-Lloyd, is it? The female assistant referee. She never gets them wrong. She's got like a third eye. You know, I've watched her time and time again. She's absolutely brilliant at it. So, but the others, you know, quite often that's the ones they get wrong.
Interesting. That explains it, because on TV it looks like such a blatant mistake, but clearly that linesman is of a certain calibre if he's reffing Manchester United Arsenal.
Yeah. It really doesn't matter. I remember I've read up a bit about it, and there was some reports done. I think it was Plus One, one of the science magazines had done it, and they basically said they cannot see it. They just have to gauge it. They have to gauge where people roughly were, because your eyes basically don't go two directions at one time. So you can't actually see it. You need to figure it out and let your brain work it out. So he couldn't see that one when it happened because of the angles of the players were at. So understandable, and that's exactly the reason why we have the VAR. And I don't think it was, I mean, I wasn't shouting and bawling and annoyed with him, but it just looks worse from our position.
So not the most important issue of the weekend, but what is the etiquette with Calvert-Lewin stealing our Seamus Coleman's goal at the weekend? Right. Does everyone in the dressing room turn around to him and say, yeah, we know you're a striker. That only gets you so much license. That only buys you so much greed.
Do you know strikers? They've just got a complete get out of jail card with that one. 100%. Anybody else does it and you get the dirty looks to some degree. But in actual fact, in reality, he did the right thing. Hate to say it for Seamus, but he did the right thing. Do you know, if you're a nice guy and you let the ball go in and you, oh, well done, you let him get the goal. One time out of 100, somebody clears it off the line on your blind side when you didn't think it was going to happen. That thing that you get that wrong is the reason why 99 times you just put it in the net. You just constantly do it. And he's right to do it. He needed a bit about himself as well, Calvert-Lewin. He was just about too nice the last couple of seasons. And this season, you're not seeing that. He's really moved on a bit. And even though Sheamus, did you see the close-ups of him? He looked furious.
I couldn't work out what he said. My lip reading wasn't quite good enough.
I couldn't catch it either. See, Sheamus Coleman is a sort of a guy who's like, you know, such a, he is a model professional. He doesn't meet that. It's not as if he's like griping about his goal bonus. Although I would look for some of the goal bonus if I was Sheamus Coleman. But I don't think he's going to be, concerned about that issue, you know? But I'd love to know what the, you know, it's only those occasions where someone risks an offside to do it where it becomes a bit of a problem, which does happen.
It didn't look like he was saying, well done on doing the professional thing.
No, it didn't look that way.
In that moment, it would probably be a bit miffed. But when he sits back and realises, and by the way, there's no way Sheamus Coleman's got a goal bonus on his contract. No chance. Yeah.
But that thing
does not happen.
Well, Calvert-Lewin probably does. So now they're cutting a deal. You know, this is the thing.
Absolutely. Do you know, it's one of the things when I was my executive role that I did, nobody gets goal bonuses. Absolutely nobody gets them. There was a concept that I might give assist bonuses, but no, nothing like that. Because in the end, you should be doing what's right for the team all the time. So it's a classic one. If you're throwing goal and there's a 70% chance of you scoring, but if you pass it to your mate, there's a 90%, you'll always do the right thing, unless you're on a goal bonus and you take that chance. You shouldn't do it. So it's one of those things. I don't think goal bonuses should be a thing anymore. I mean, let's be fair, they don't need the extra wee few quid, do they?
Are they still pretty prevalent, goal bonuses at the top level?
You don't hear much about them. It's not. Mm. I'm sure there's one or two around, but I'm not convinced it's a big thing.
Yeah.
There's one or two players you just think, because that's all they can do. Like Batshuayi down at Chelsea. I mean, just give him a goal bonus. That's fine. That's all he does anyway. Yeah. It doesn't matter whether anybody's in a different position. He just gets the ball and kicks the ball towards goal. That's all he does. Kind of works for him right enough, but it's kind of, I would never have it. It breeds animosity in a team. It's not a good thing. And I still think Calvert-Lewin did the right thing.
As for Everton generally, are they living up to your pre-season tag of being the great entertainers that you were hoping for?
Not as much as I hoped they would be. They've been okay, you know, they've been all right. But, you know, it's not quite there yet. And the big one is Keane's still not done it yet. And Calvert-Lewin's getting more headlines than Moise Kean's getting. And I'm getting quite frustrated. But, I mean, he's just new in the scene. He's just turned up. He's a kid, all that sort of stuff. Still not concerned about him. And remember, he's not much different in age than someone like Tammy Abraham. You know, so we always give him a little bit of leeway and others at that age a bit of leeway. And even though Keane, because he's bulked up and he's muscular and he doesn't look young, he is very young. So give him a bit of leeway, but I still think there's enough quality there for them to be, you know, well up there. And if they get a good run together, there's no reason why they couldn't do top six. And I think they gave Man City a right good game. I mean, Pep certainly looked a bit miffed afterwards with the amount of opportunities that Everton got in that game. Having said that, the right team won without a shadow of a doubt, and they looked a bit special when they've turned it on. I've seen them a couple of times this season when they've really fancied it, and they're stunning.
Yeah. The highlights, I only saw the highlights, but they certainly suggested that Riyad Mahrez in particular was enjoying life out there.
Yeah, it's a very, very odd one though, because you know De Bruyne will start, you know that Sterling will start, but Sterling is a wee bit like, you know, Mahrez is coming in. Mahrez has got far more skill than Sterling has. He's got all those extra things that Sterling hasn't got, but he's that kind of willingness to put yourself out for the team all the time is the one thing they clearly had missing for certain periods of time. And he is a very, when you stand beside Riyad Mahrez, I don't know if you stood beside him before, when you stand beside most professional footballers, they've got, you know, they're mostly big and muscular and bulky these days and really built. And you stand beside Mahrez and you think, I could break him. Mm. He still looks really skinny. He still doesn't look like that type at all. And when he goes in for tackles, a lot of the time they are either half-hearted or he just doesn't want to know. It was a wee bit more for himself. But you don't need to be a battler. You just need to be neat and nippy. Again, there's lots of players in the league who they're wiry, and you use that wiriness. And that's the thing that Mahrez didn't want to do for quite a long time. Mm. He's going to have to do that. Everybody knows he's going to have to do that if you're going to get a game every week under Pep.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Liverpool benefited from a goalkeeping mistake, and Jurgen Klopp said if the game had finished nil-all, he would have had no qualms whatsoever. It would have been a fair result. One of the things I want to ask you about here, the game was the game, and then they got the bit of luck that you need sometimes, and they keep their run going. So they've won their first seven games only for the second time. 1990-91 was the last time they managed to do that. A lot of people now are observing that Joel Matip and his run out from defence is proving very effective, and it's almost a ritual in every game. They look forward to it when he just eyes up the gap and takes the opportunity to go and take it as far as he can and gets pretty close to goal and often draws a man and gets things moving. People likening it to Alan Hansen, for instance, a more clunky version of Alan Hansen, maybe. But it is a thing that I'm sure you saw Alan Hansen do it.
You can
talk about that as well. It'd be interesting. But it is a thing, like, anytime a defender does it, it completely changes the dynamics of the pitch. It draws a man. Suddenly everything changes if you have a defender who can do that. We don't see it that often.
You don't see that often, and it's a real shame. There are certain players that, you know, have done it over the years and done it brilliantly. I can remember Ricardo Carvalho used to be brilliant at that, until Mourinho got hold of him and told him not to stand over a halfway line or he's going to sub him, which was a real shame. But there have been lots and lots of players, as you say. Hansen famously was good at it. You talk about Matip, I watched Van Dijk doing it week after week up at Celtic, and it was astonishing. And he didn't just go and, you know, go 10, 15, 20 yards forward. He went an amazing dribble down the right or the left hand wing, and then he would go and play a brilliant through ball or hit a ball from 40 yards out, it would hit the crossbar. So Matip's good at it, or getting better at it, and you're right, it changes the dynamic of the play, because you're set up to mark your man in that midfield, and then suddenly there's this complete interloper in the middle of it, and it just drags everyone. It's the classic one, you, to use the football terminology, which bores me senseless usually, you've got to break the lines. When you break the lines, it causes confusion. That's why you get Mahrez, that's why you get De Bruyne, or these people go beyond people, break a line, and then suddenly you get confusion. That doesn't matter what line it is. You know, if you're Matip or if you're Van Dijk and you break that line, it confuses the life out of everyone. It shouldn't really, because when Matip goes there, then Henderson or Milner or Wijnaldum, they should be dropping back in his position. That's exactly what's happened, because should happen. Because either that or one of your fullbacks should tuck round. Ain't going to happen with Liverpool, because they don't do that. Or else you've got Van Dijk has to take care of everything in himself. So if one of the midfielders drops back, then it shouldn't really be a big problem for the midfielders and the opposition. But it is, and it confuses life out of them. So yeah, it works well.
Yeah, Harry Maguire started doing it a little bit once or twice, and he was, you know, you referenced Rio Ferdinand used to do it a lot for United. I kind of wonder, is it the next big thing that we'll see managers pushing players to do more? Because sometimes the game is just so static. And what's the big fear of a defender? I'm going to lose the ball and suddenly we're in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, remember Stones did it quite a lot a couple of seasons ago. He was driving it in the midfield quite a bit, and they would have, was it Fernandinho would sit in beside him and just let him go. But you need to be good enough on the ball. You need to have the vision. You've got everything in front of you. And it's a brilliant position to have the ball running at people who don't want to engage with you because you're not their man. And also you can see 180 ahead of you and see everything that's going on. But you also have the vision to pick something else out when you get there. Now, Matip's pickouts, they seem to me, to be honest, mostly to feet and to strikers or wide players. He's not clipping balls over the top, you know, beautifully a la De Bruyne to get somebody running in. He's not doing that yet. But, you know, that might actually come. Who are the players that are going to do that? That's the more of the question you're going to ask. Who are the players going to step into that sort of area? Well, we know there's one guy on the pitch tonight who's not bad at doing that, Mr. Luiz, but, you know, he's not going to be the future of anything after a couple of years. So who's it going to be? I have absolute confidence there are going to be a few of them, because see the English players that are coming through just now, that come through that academy system, and particularly through in England, they are so comfortable with the ball at their feet. I have absolutely no doubt that there's going to be two or three coming through very, very soon.
Yeah.
Was Hansen a rarity?
Oh, aye, at the time, yeah. I mean, nowadays you talk about, you know, the gegen press and the high pressure squeeze and all that sort of stuff. Right, that's not new. What that is what everybody used to do, which was let the centre-backs get the ball, then squeeze them, because they're garbage, right? They can't kick a ball. They can't play football, with a very, very few exceptions, and one of them being Mr. Hansen himself. And he was just so comfortable in the ball, so relaxed on the ball, and he always seemed to have so much time in the ball, and he wasn't even particularly quick. He was good at it, but, you know, not again playing 70 yard passes, but just playing the right pass into midfield and knowing when to step up. Now he was good, but, and a rarity, but not the only one. Over the years I've seen many. The thing is, we kind of lost, as I mean, we British football kind of lost it a wee bit for about 10, 15, maybe even 20 years, whereas the Italians and all that and the Spanish were sort of working in that sort of, those sort of principles. the Brits are beginning to do it a wee bit better, and particularly the English.
Mm.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, because even with the Irish hat on, I mean, I went to see Brighton last week, and Shane Duffy's actually in a bit of bother at Brighton at the moment, because it looks like Graham Potter is very much in that philosophy, and he's going for like three centre halves, and the feeling is that maybe he's looking for ones that are more comfortable stepping out and being a bit more comfortable in that situation. And that, I don't know, Pat, like the more old school centre half with old school characteristics, it's not that they're vulnerable, because there's always going to be a place for them, but it's a skill you sort of need to have to, I assume, to advance to a top four, top six club, which we probably would have talked about Shane Duffy in those terms, you know, in terms of his importance for Ireland, but maybe he can't do it in that way. I don't know.
Not to the very, very top clubs, maybe, because you probably still have one kind of hard defender, you know, one that he's a decent player, but he's not the one who's going to play out for the back. And if you play with two at the back, as long as one of them can come out with the ball, that's probably going to be enough, as long as you're not, say, Man City. Mm. If it's a three in the back, you probably ought to be able to do it, because if you're the right or the left, you're going to be wide and you're going to get a lot of the ball. And if you're a central one, you've got to be able to play it, who dictates the play. So you're right, if it's a three at the back. Having said that, what's going on at Brighton absolutely confuses the life out of me. I done some analysis of them last week for them coming to the Chelsea game. And you're trying to figure out, A, how they were going to play, B, who was going to play, and C, who the hell was going to play where? Because they all play different positions all the time. It's the weirdest thing. And that is absolutely brilliant if everybody's comfortable with it. Problem is, just like you say, they're not, are they? They're not all comfortable. And he made a tactical change the weekend, Potter, against Chelsea. First half, they'd nailed it. They got their number eight, whose name escapes me just now, they got him to man-mark Jorginho. And honestly, Chelsea, although the better team, they were really quite stifled in that first half. He only took him off at half-time. Chelsea cruised it in the second half. It was the weirdest thing. He made this massive big tactical change. And if I had to choose one player in their team not to take off, he took off that player at half-time. I was absolutely stunned by it. I mean, he might have been injured, who knows, but I was amazed by it.
Meanwhile, yesterday, Newcastle, who play Manchester United on Sunday, had a terrible time of it. Newcastle players told not to come into training after Leicester's humiliation. Luke Edwards writing here. So Newcastle's players remained completely silent during what Luke Edwards writes was a brutal appraisal of their performance by manager Steve Bruce. He questioned their desire, their ability. An expletive-ridden outburst minutes after the final whistle. Bruce questioned the attitude of the team, accused them of trying to hide behind him since he was appointed as Rafa's replacement because they know he'll take flak for the results. According to one witness inside the dressing room, I'm sure Steve Bruce feels a whole lot better about the situation reading this. According to one witness inside the dressing room at the King Power Stadium, the extent of Bruce's anger left the entire team hanging their heads in shame. And tellingly, there was not a murmur of discontent. They just stared at the floor, the source told Telegraph Sport. Bruce then told his players on the Sunday evening, don't come training on Monday, as he didn't want to see them so soon after the debacle at Leicester. And he told his staff that he could not promise he would not explode a second time if he saw them so soon, so he needed some time away from them. So, that sounds fun, to say the least. I mean, is it a good old-fashioned angry rant at full time, telling them how terrible they've all been. Has that completely gone out of fashion here, or sometimes is not the worst thing in the world?
Sometimes it harms. Definitely sometimes it harms. The thing is, it's rarer now than it was in times gone past, and that's a good thing. Don't go to that well too often. If you go to that well too often, people just get bored with it, and then you just start questioning the manager. I've seen it often happen. But now and again, throwing that one in there, it's a kind of slightly nuclear option, but I think he's tearing his hair out. He doesn't know where else to go with it. The thing is, I didn't see the entire game. I was like yourself. I was dipping in and out of that game. And to be fair, they're a man down. You know, they're away from home. It's against a really good Leicester team. And it was an important man down as well. When you look at the team that was left out there, there was a hell of a lot of players that weren't set up to be hard-working, you know, stoic defensive-type players. You know, the changes weren't made to make it that way. Now, you know, Steve obviously doesn't want to make too many changes because, you know, they could get injuries, all that sort of stuff, and you have to question the quality he's got on the bench as well. But what was left there in that 10 men didn't strike me as a team that you would be wanting to play as a 10-man team to defend with their lives. So, you know, there's a bit of you saying, right, the players are a bit miffed. You're a bit miffed for the players. And if they weren't working hard, you know, Steve's there, he's watched it, and he's top guy. But there's also a question to say, well, wait a minute. That didn't used to happen very often under Rafa, because they were so structured and they were so organised. Mm. They weren't brilliant, but they were structured and they were organised. And if he's saying that they're hiding behind, you know, him getting abuse, that's basically saying, none of you lot trust in me.
Mm.
And that's just kind of the wrong thing to say. Mm. You shouldn't say that. You need to keep as many of them as on side as possible, particularly if it's difficult times. And they're going to have some difficult times. I mean, I'll be at that game at the weekend when Manchester United play up at Newcastle, and I'll be intrigued to see how they react to it, those players, because there are two ways you can react to it. You know what those two ways are. One of them is just thumb your nose up at the manager. The idea, to me, you're saying there about the just take a day off.
Yeah.
That's sensible. That's all right, because they won't lose any fitness. There's no problem there. Having said that, they did look a bit sluggish, but they won't lose any match fitness. But they'll have a wee bit of time to think about it. And they'll come back, and he'll see when they come back. I don't think there's any big downside of them giving a day off to just think about it a bit.
Or else they all said, whoa, let's go to London and have a good night out and have a good time and do some shopping. And well, we'll see next week. So just the last one, Leicester. They're up to third now. Where are you on the Brendan Rodgers spectrum? He's a divisive enough manager, yeah, depending on who you talk to. And it ranges from David Brent got very lucky that he had Luis Suarez spearheading that brilliant season and then went up to Celtic where, okay, you can say he did a great job, but frankly, you know, what was the opposition? Two people saying, this guy's obviously clearly a brilliant manager, did a great job at Swansea, almost won the league, Liverpool. They played brilliant football that season. Anyone can have a bad hangover. Did a great job at Celtic, and now he's doing it again at Leicester. This guy is a fantastic manager. Now, don't you dare tell me the truth is always somewhere in between, because that's the cop-out answer. I want to know where you are on this.
Can I try another cop-out one?
Yeah.
We'll find out this season. And I think you do, in a way, don't you?
This could be the referendum, this job on Rodgers.
Right, no, I'll tell you what, I actually think he is a good coach, and I think he's a good technical coach as well. I think he does rob football people within the game up the wrong way. You know, some of the things that is constantly said, and it's not definitely not from me, because anytime I've spoke to him, I've found him brilliant.
Mm.
But he said that he's quite pleased with himself.
Mm.
You know, he's not absolutely in love with himself. They tend to keep that for Jose, but you know, he's quite keen on himself and how he's seen. And if you're like that in a game and you're a bit precious about it, people can turn in on you very, very quickly when things go wrong. And they've done that with him, and they thought he was getting a wee bit uppity, as it were, really early on. So that was the thoughts and the ideas that I was getting inside the game. And it was lots of, and I just couldn't get it, because, you know, I'd spent a bit of time, I've met him quite a few times, and I just had never quite seen it. But then you watch him on camera sometimes, and particularly if there's a documentary, and you think, yeah, I'm not sure you should have done that, Brendan. That's not going to get down that well, mate. But none of that matters. It's all secondary. It's just pure results. So, yeah, he did do a good job with Celtic. Not so great in Europe a lot of the time. I think he did a brilliant job with Liverpool. I thought he was really unlucky to lose his job there, personally.
Mm.
If he does get Leicester into the top four this season, I think he can call it and just say, no, guy's a really good manager. He's been given quite a few jobs and generally does really well with them.
Pat, brilliant stuff. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks a million.
Speak to you soon, Jack.
Cheers. Pat and Evan there. Give us your thoughts on tonight and the weekend. Our football coverage is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. Dan, you've been keeping a vague eye on Man United 1, Arsenal 1.
Yeah, 3 minutes into 4 minutes of stoppage time, Rashford just had a free kick at the edge of the box. Stupid foul by David Luiz and McTominay. Great save by Leno. I wasn't sure if Rashford and Pogba were having a bit of a chat over who should take it. Or Pogba was certainly having words about something, but it was a pretty good effort, pretty good save. But yeah, we're petering out. We're not petering out. We're heading towards a 1-1.
We are a little bit petering.
Yeah, Manchester United have been applying some pressure without necessarily hammering the door down. Won a series of corners and so on, but not really sustained banging the door down. But that was a good save by Leno.
John says if Dan took a role in the football family, he'd have no time to slag off the rugby family, which is a great point.
Well, we'd be co-tenants. You know?
That's true. What price are your tickets? Because I feel we've overpriced ours.
Well, I mean that actually has already happened. You know, that's even how ludicrous it was. Even our mates in the IRFU said that 15 grand flat rate. We'll go. Let's go double that and not play that many big games in certain years.
Yeah.
That'll pay for it.
33,000 millionaires in the country.
Yeah, 3,200 a year. Who are we playing this year? Gibraltar. That's the only competitive game we've got. Don't worry, that'll work.
Mm. So I'm being told I've to wrap the show after this ad break solo because you're hightailing it to another media organisation.
That's not strictly true.
Whenever you see a John Delaney story, do you just ring your bank manager and say, we're going to throw in a conservatory?
Not really, no. I saw John Delaney story at 11:15 on Saturday night and saw the next 4 to 5 hours disappear.
I can imagine.
Into the early hours of the morning.
I can imagine.
No.
Yeah. So you're on Virgin Media in what, an hour, half an hour?
I'll be grand, Joe.
An hour?
I'll be grand, yeah.
Very good.
Well, you know what it's like out there, you know?
Sure do.
Got to get changed.
Makeup, of course, all that jazz.
Yeah, you're the expert. Even Richard Cooper has even done you now. That's how big you've become. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, you got it all
wrong.
Any
comment on that? Are you happy with the impersonation?
It was completely wrong, but that's fair enough. Did I tell you about my award? No, we're off.
I thought it was pretty accurate.
Did you? Oh,
yeah, I did, yeah. And pause.
I mean, the thing with the pause is I just can't think what to say sometimes.
Let it go, Joe.
There's nothing dramatic going on.
Let it go.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag SaveOurShirt.
And John Delaney, the statement came through on Saturday evening, very short and to the point. The board of the FAI announces the resignation with immediate effect of Executive Vice President and former CEO John Delaney. This follows talks between the parties. The FAI will fulfil certain notice and pension obligations as agreed between the parties. In terms of listing out his achievements, they're giving him a lengthy thank you for his service. That didn't happen. They simply say, Mr. Delaney served as CEO of the FAI between 05 to March 2019, during which time the FAI became partners in the new Aviva Stadium, 2017, though it should be 2019. He was elected to the UEFA Executive. Sorry, they have that right. In 2017, he was elected to the UEFA Executive, and then in March of this year, he moved to a role of Executive Vice President of the FAI. Both parties, the final line, both parties have agreed to make no further comment. So that came through after 11 o'clock on Saturday. Even that, right. So I'm going to play devil's advocate at points and be fair to the FAI, especially when we talk about the reasons they had to pay him off. But even that statement, and the FAI have been espousing their newfound virtues, efforts and transparency. This was Gibraltar, meet your new executive vice president, late night, all over again. Do they think this is clever? Do they think people like this kind of behaviour? Do they think it's becoming of the organisation that they're trying to become? Are they completely ignorant of how the timing of the post-Gibraltar match statement was greeted and interpreted by everyone, even though in their own minutes they seem to think it might be a bit of a masterstroke?
They're going to come back, they're going to get things back to nil all.
Yes.
It's sort of surprising because you can't actually even get back to nil all if you've gone behind in a game.
Correct. So did they think this worked out so well before that we should do this again? This is the type of new era that we want to be a part of. Even that was just a very odd choice. That's Is there any mitigating reason why they might have done it?
It would appear, and this is sort of more than one source, I guess, in the sense that that it's possible, and I don't think people are going to believe this story no matter what people say, because of the past examples where it was clearly a ploy and a strategy to, like, you know, throw something out late to try and sort of throw Sundays off the scent. The view that has been put forward is that actually the talks they were nearly completed on Friday and they did go through Saturday, and that there was a genuine timing issue with this, i.e. That things only did get finished up late enough on Saturday night, and this is what happened. Now, you can look at me with sort of a semi-skeptical face, and like when I've heard that was my instincts as well. But you know, people are saying that who would sort of have a knowledge of things that were happening. So you can make of it what you will. You know, if it was done on Saturday night, would you want to get it out? I mean, you still know. By sending it out at 11:15, let's say things were wrapped up at 10 to 11 on Saturday evening, which is, I think, the suggestion that there might have been something like that. What do you think? Well, actually, you know, it's late on Saturday night. We might have got a couple of queries about something. Will we do it in the morning? you know, at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and time it around the, you know, the news at one or whatever it might be. And clearly the decision was made, well, no, let's put out this statement now and that's it. So I think, you know what an 11:15 p.m. Saturday statement means. It's like it's sleepy time in the week, and the Sunday papers have already print deadlines. That'd be very well known in the business as such. But there is a suggestion that the talks did fall along those lines. I met inquiries 10 days ago or so to see where things stood with Delaney. And at that point, there was a suggestion that talks were going on, but that it could take a while. There was an impasse, you know. And I'm still a bit surprised that it's happened that quickly from then. But people are saying that that was just an unfortunate coincidence, but they probably haven't earned, there's an element of not earning the belief of people on that one because of the past experience where it was definitely a strategy.
What do we know about the size of the payout, and what do we know about the nature of negotiations? I presume both sides were lawyered up here.
Yeah, and you go back to April, and that day we were in it was the Carlton Hotel, I think, at Dublin Airport, and there was, John Delaney was up in the room with members of the FBI board. I think there was like a subcommittee board and then the board itself, and that was the day there was a lot going on, people leaving through back exits and side exits, and there was lawyers and people in the building. And actually, that previous weekend, there'd been strong suggestions that, you know, they'd been close to a deal. I think even, this is like something like Friday, April the 12th or something like that, you know, or that sort of time frame, that there was nearly an agreement then. And
he was put on guardian leave 3 days later.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, that 15th. Monday, 15th. Yeah, okay, then, yeah, it was around that time. That weekend, there was certainly, at one point, there was strong rumour that he was gone, whether that meant showing the door or you know, a settlement. And then I think there was advice that came in late to the FBI that you need to think about your actions here. This could be tricky and this could be complicated. And I think that hasn't really changed. And I think the slight frustration would be maybe that, like, John Delaney was paid for 5 months while on gardening leave.
40,000 a month.
Yeah. And, you know, does the difference between the settlement then and now, how does that weigh up against the difference between that 5 months pay if you do your sums? I think it's like 175 grand or something as a figure you could make a rough estimate of the wages you might have accrued during that period. What the settlement this time? There's conflicting figures on the statement. I've heard sort of around that 350 grand territory, maybe a small bit more.
Emma Malone was reporting 500.
There's 500. I mean, there's different figures. I think the Sun, who've been very good throughout this, had 450. So there's different figures going around the place. People have heard heard different things. I've heard maybe on that 350, 400 end of the scale, the 350, to be honest, is what I heard. But different figures doing the rounds. Either way.
So you've heard 350, the Sun have heard 450, Emma Malone's heard 500.
Yeah, it's that ballpark. And I think, you know, it's probably cost the FBI around $500,000 either way, because he would have accrued that 175 in wages during that period. But the massive element of that would have been like pension entitlements. And that was the biggest thing here. It wasn't so much like, people have been through a process of like statutory payments or stuff like that. It was very much like pension entitlements, and money had been paid into a pot over a long period of time for a very highly paid employee since 2005. And that was the biggest complication. And ultimately, you asked me, I didn't really answer the question in terms of, what's been happening since or what's the situation, that in recent weeks, ultimately they've had discussions where it's become clear that, this impasse is set to continue over a long period, in that John Delaney has a defence and his team have a defence of his time there along the lines of, well, things that he did that might come out in subsequent financial reviews, and he got approval for it from the right officers and the right people and so on. The FBI might take a different view, but I don't think it's black and white. A lot of people say, well, why don't they just come out and sack him? I think the equation, they came into a situation where there was an equation, there was a sum, and did they have the grounds to do that? It would appear that they didn't.
So the complicating factor here is that all the decisions he's made, right back to, even we'll touch on it in a few moments, the Vantage Club and the stadium, right through to any other ill-judged decisions, which I'm sure he will argue were for the good of the association.
But absolutely.
The complicating factor is that all of the decisions made were passed by the FAI board.
Yeah.
The board oversaw this, and that arguably weakens the case of the FAI when Donald Conway and Paul Cook, who's the new vice president, when they sat down to negotiate with Delaney's legal team, that legal team could turn around to Cook and Conway and say, your board looked at everything he did, including the 2021 €2 million loyalty bonus, and your board said, we agree.
That was signed off on by, you know, and now there's always been a, there's been a dispute over that as to how many people were aware of the terms and conditions, and that raises a whole issue of, you know, in internal governance, which we know wasn't the best. You know, that's why they've had an entire governance review. But yeah, was Anthony going to come out? There's a Sport Ireland commissioned audit which looks into sort of financial payments and checks and balances, and the Mazars one, which I think it might be more thorough, but it was commissioned by the FAI internally. But that will expose probably that their practices could have been better. But, you know, people will talk about it, say the issues related to, you know, his credit card and expense payments and deals and stuff would have grated with people, and certainly caused, you know, when that information came out in the Sunday Times initially, that it caused massive damage, I think, to his standing with a lot of people around the country.
Yeah.
But he could still legitimately argue, it would appear, well, those terms and conditions were signed off on by here and by here and by here, these people here. So, like, that's why you're heading for an impasse. And the situation is, what's the better scenario here? Do you pay as much as it still
rankles
with people? Do you pay this substantial sum now? Or do you risk going into a sort of a lengthy court battle or employment procedure when already, as far as I know, the FAI's legal bill for the last, you know, since this crisis kicked, is getting to around 1.5 million mark. That's for everything, you know. So
does that include the report?
Yeah. So if you're on about, like, you're facing a scenario where you're talking like high-powered legal people would need to be involved in this, and they don't come cheap.
The senior counsel.
The game. So they needed a line under this. They needed this done. This was something that they needed fixed.
Yes.
And that's the price that they had to pay. And I completely appreciate, I'm not saying like this line that this is a great deal, that I think there's an FAI sort of, they want that out there as a thing. I still find it hard to use those words, but it was probably an understandable one.
Because I presume the people around the negotiating table would have a fair idea of what's in the reports, the first of which is going to be published next Monday.
The COSI one next Monday, the Sport Ireland commissioned one, yeah.
So everyone around the table knows potentially what's coming down the line here. Because I've heard it said, well, why not wait for the reports? And that might give you ammunition to take a dismissal case against John Delaney, for instance.
Mm.
So clearly the FAI didn't feel there was enough in those reports, or maybe it's because the board have been complicit that they felt, well, we're just going to have to negotiate with John Delaney here and get this done regardless of what's coming around the corner. Now, those reports either way will prove what the right decision was, but you would have to say, in defence of the FAI contingent here, they would know or have a fair idea, we think, we presume, but who knows what's in those reports, and they still felt, let's just get this done, let's part ways with John Delaney.
Yeah, that's what they had to do. And there was like a, with regard to, say, sponsors in UEFA as well, that would have been their view that also, like, the retention of John Delaney on the books was possibly an obstacle to other things being done. And I think it's all a sum here. And the cost of that, you know, the pros outweighed the cons, but it's still like, you know, it's still a con that is, I think, is very damaging in terms of the public perception.
What would the average wage be of an FAI employee?
I don't know, but I mean, there would be a lot of FAI employees at a lower level, you know, that they'd be in the 28, 30, 35 bracket.
Yeah.
Some of them back in the day would have been co-funded as well. They'd have certain partnerships, and some would still exist, but there'd be a lot of lowly paid employees in the FAI. There's been a high turnover of staff. That's obviously, you know, and particularly sort of entry level roles and stuff. So there's people that are not earning big money. And yeah, you look at the figures. I mean, there's a lot going on in Irish football at the moment. So you even look at 350, the lower end of it, you still end up thinking, what would 350 do? Or the 350 plus the 175 during his time, like, you know, I mean, the 6 million in his tenure in terms of wages.
Yeah.
I mean,
before
John Delaney's done very well out of Irish football.
Before expenses.
Like, you mean, like, he has done extremely well out of Irish football.
The next point I want to get to. So increasingly, different people are writing pieces. You wrote one over the weekend. Ken Early wrote one in the Irish Times today. Neil O'Riordan has written one. Paul Lennon, I saw you quote an anecdote, which is faintly believable, about a chauffeur meeting them off the flight to bring them to the airport. So the level of spending here in certain areas of the association was ridiculous, really, in some respects. Are the FAI on the brink here? Like, are they pretty much on the brink of insolvency? Because it seems UEFA are set to loan them anything up to, and you can correct me on the figure, but I've read anything up to 20 million.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, I mean, Donald Conway has previously confirmed, I think, that, you know, a figure of 10 to 12 million within a one calendar year period is very feasible. But of course, there's no suggestion that this is all going to be within 1 year, you know, that it's going to be ongoing support. I don't think it's a case of, you know, here you go now. Like, this is, there's advance payments being brought forward from deals and other funding arrangements that I don't think anyone has put a firm final figure on it. I mean, at times I've tried to get that figure off people and they didn't actually just know. And that's, I mean, to answer your question, your initial question, without UEFA support, would the FAI be in a form, would there be insolvent? This is opinion, but I'd say it's probably informed enough opinion that I think there's a very good chance they would be in that position. Yes, they would. So
this is ridiculous.
So, I mean, it's an incredible legacy to leave when you consider that if none of this had come out, we would probably have had an AGM this year where we would have been told that the FAI would be debt free next year. There might have been a plan to persevere and press ahead with that target, which would have involved bringing forward funding and other payments. And so I know other costs have come out, you know, because of this, but ultimately it was always delaying.
Yeah.
The suspicions that were held about the true financial picture. And we are told in November, because the FAI AGM was adjourned and it will reopen in November with the business of the accounts, we are told that we will get a pretty grim picture of the FAI finances and where we stand. And I mean, people from talking about being debt-free in 2020, it has been conceded that it could be 2030. And that wasn't even a by 2030, definitely, maybe less. Like, this is what we're looking at. It's another restructuring of debt. So, you know, a stadium that was launched in 2008, opened in 2010, that by, and it was supposed to be like providing a pension to Irish football from 2020 onwards, is still going to be a source and subject of debt in 2030, maybe 2035. Amazingly, there are still sort of people who would go around and suggest that, and I was sort of writing about this in the piece today, having heard John O'Regan from Kerry talking this morning, would suggest that, like, that John Delaney delivering the Aviva Stadium is one of his great achievements, as though that Irish football without one man could never have found a solution of a stadium, you know, in partnership with the government and the IRFU.
Yeah.
Like, that's just something that...
It's where we've managed to conjure the lost, in a third world country.
How has everyone lost their confidence so much that they don't actually realise that football in this country is played by a lot of people and, you know, has a massive attraction to a lot of people, and that somehow, if it wasn't for one man's skill, no money or funding or anything would have come to the game. It's when you sit back and just and look at that, it's frankly, it's like ludicrous.
Yeah.
And amazingly, like, the FA will continue to get sponsors now.
Yeah.
They will survive eventually.
It's incredibly grim. It's a scandal that that's where we are.
Yep.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using #SaveOurShirt.